Hi, and welcome to the Beyond the Peloton podcast. I'm your host, Spencer Martin. We're taking a closer look at the sport of professional cycling, recapping and analyzing races that have happened and previewing future races. Today, we are going over Vuelta a Burgos and Strada Bianchi, which both occurred this past weekend, and we'll be previewing the Milano-San Remo Monument Classic, which is happening this coming weekend. It's an incredibly hard race to predict, almost impossible to ever pick a winner there. So it's take everything with a grain of salt. And if you are gambling on this race, do it purely for fun. Don't wager anything too significant. And I'll have the Beyond the Peloton newsletter coming out later this week with a little bit, some visual aids on the Strada Bianchi breakdown and going into a little bit more depth on Milano San Remo. Subscribe to that at beyondthepeloton.substack.com. I highly recommend it. There's some great stuff in there. And also, since we have no ads on the newsletter or the podcast, you can support me by buying me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/BTPpod. BTPpod at the end of that. Thank you for anyone who's done that. So this past weekend, we had two major races. I should say one major race, the Strada Bianchi race in the Tuscan, the white roads of Tuscany, and the final stage of the Vuelta a Burgos. Let's start with Strada Bianchi. What a win by Wout van Aert. That was just a treat of a race. It was incredible to watch him kind of come into his own as a classics rider on that tough, tough course. I apologize in advance. I recommended Eurosport on the last podcast, and it was absolutely terrible. I think they're owned by the Discovery Channel Corporation and Discovery Corp, and they have they bought the Global Cycling Network, GCN, and they have like a new premium pass that they're trying to sell. So even if you have a Eurosport player subscription, they now want you to buy the GCN pass. So it didn't work. I found it didn't work well. I ended up buying Flow Sports, which is like an over-the-top streaming service in the U.S. But the race didn't start. The TV coverage didn't start until 60 kilometers to go in a 184-kilometer race. And most of the action took place well before that. So I was saying last weekend how I always found this to be an odd race that it's incredibly, I don't really have a good feel for it. And I realized because I've never seen that much of it. You only watch the last 50, 60K. Everything's already broken up by then. So you just, it's really hard to get a feel for this race. And I found it ridiculous that there hasn't been any racing for 5 months and they return to the sport. People are excited to watch this race and they just do this Mickey Mouse TV job where they had two camera motos, that covered the women's race. And when they finished that, they had to drive back onto the course to film the men's race. And of course, they can't film the whole thing that way. They could just film the last 60K. So nobody knows. There's no pictures of what happened from the start until 60 kilometers to go. So over 100 kilometers of racing is just gone. And that happened to be the most exciting part of the race. It's hard to imagine another professional sport where the most exciting part of the event just doesn't make it to the TV broadcast. And it's RCS is the race organizer, and they're just kind of a shoddy organization, and it showed with this. I was incredibly disappointed. I woke up and slammed 15 cups of coffee at 6 a.m. I was bouncing around like an atom, so excited to watch this race, and had to wait like 2.5 hours. I saw some roadside videos on Twitter, and like that's the best we could get. It just seems ridiculous. I don't know how they expect to get any new fans when you literally can't watch significant portions of the event. Completely ridiculous. But apologies on the Eurosport recommendation. Flow Sports, was late, but everyone else was. It wasn't their fault. I found it to be pretty good. So I'm going to keep both subscriptions for now, and I'll kind of, I'll recommend one or the other, by the end of the year. I think Flow Sports doesn't have as good of a selection of races, but we'll keep an eye on that. But the winner of the race, Wout van Aert, the Belgian sensation, won the race. It was incredible. It was a Fabian Cancellara-esque win, in my opinion. And this race just looked so hard. It looked incredibly hard. It was just chaos. It was almost like watching like a high-level amateur race or something where it was just breaking up far out. Just those guys were riding as hard as they could not to get dropped with 60, 50K to go, and then just surviving on the way in. And you saw Like Greg Van Avermaet's one of the strongest riders in the world, and he was just like the caboose on the back of the six-man pace line coming into the finish, just hanging on. He would never leave that last wheel because he was hurting so bad. And that gives you an idea for how hard this race was. So just notes up top. Wout Van Aert won. David Formolo was second. And Max Schachmann was third, who we discussed last week. I said his odds were way too good. I didn't know why he was being favored that much. I was wrong. I mean, he looked really good in this one-day race. He's kind of the only real success he has is from one-week stage races. Like, he won Paris-Nice earlier this year. He was third at Liège-Bastogne-Liège last year, which is a hard one-day race. So he could be, you know, maybe in the future someone to keep an eye on. He looked very good. All three podium finishes were in their 20s, which we talked about last week. This tends to be a young man's race because, I would guess, just because of the shorter distance. And the old guys looked really old. The old established riders like, Peter Sagan's not that old. I think he's 30 years old. But Greg Van Avermaet's 35. He looked like he was really hurting. Jakob Fuglsang looked good for a while. He's 35, but he got dropped coming into the finish. Philippe Gilbert, we didn't even see him. He didn't even make the final selection. So we don't quite know what happened. He possibly got a flat, but it seemed like everyone got flats. If a flat cannot derail your race here, you've got to be able to ride through that. And it's hard to tell with him. He's 38, which is like, it's like a dinosaur in this sport. He could come back, and we'll know by the end of this weekend what's going on, but those guys, it wasn't a great showing from them. I'm just going to go through my race notebook really quick, and we'll talk about some key points in that race. I can't go through as much as I'd like. You know, I missed the most selective part of the race, probably from like 120K to go to 60K to go. I just don't have any information on what happened there. So that's disappointing, but we can start from 60K to go. So this is where the TV coverage started. This is when the race started to break up. With 52 kilometers to go, there's there's like maybe a 35 rider peloton. They hit a section of gravel. It's a short and steep climb, and it kind of pulls out the lead group that we had coming into the finish. So that would be Greg Van Avermaet, Max Schachmann, David Formolo, Wout Van Aert, Alberto Bettiol, who had a great race here. I didn't see that coming. And Jakob Fuglsang. So, and he kind of drives this. So it's a short, steep climb. Race is really hard here. This is Alaphilippe gets dropped, just straight up dropped. He claimed he had six punctures, three bike changes, etc. It's like everyone's riding on the same stuff. Like, if you're having that many flats, maybe you need to look into your tire choices. Like, what's going on there? Quickstep always seems to struggle on gravel. I don't know if it's, maybe they're running like a really supple tire that works on cobblestones, but is punctured easily by gravel. It's odd to me that he would have that many flats knowing that the race is going to be like this. Matthew Vanderpoel, pre-race favorite by a mile, is also dropped here. And they just looked, I mean, maybe they possibly had a lot of mechanical trouble. I don't doubt that, but they looked cooked here. They did not look strong. Jakob Fuglsang on the front, really pushing hard, and it causes the split. Actually, Brent Buchwalter, an American who's just a long journeyman career, makes the split here. Really impressive. And our eventual winner, Wout Van Aert, almost gets dropped here. If you go back and look at the footage, they're kind of cresting a climb. Jakob's driving really hard on the front, and Wout's just barely hanging on in the back. He's last wheel, dangling off. His head is down. Like, I think if he gets dropped there, he's done. He can't come back. He hangs on, and it proved important because he'll go on to win the race. Fuglsang looked really good here. Like, if I was picking a winner at 50K out, I would have bet on Jakob Fuglsang. But as we talked about last week, he's 35. I was starting to doubt myself here. I was like, oh, maybe I should have picked him. What was I thinking? But he goes off the front. He flies off the front, gets a 20-second gap. It's a pretty big gap. And normally, that's a little dicey. You're 50K from the finish. You're by yourself. There's a motivated chase group behind you. But this race is so hard that once you go, it's hard to pull you back. It's really up and down, curvy. There's no straight roads. There's a lot of gravel. So a big group actually doesn't have the advantage here that they have at a normal, more modern race. So I didn't love the move, but I can see where he's coming from. You know, if he's strong and he can, you know, turn that 20-second gap into like a minute, I don't think they can pull him back. But they kind of circle the wagons, pull him back. But during that effort, this is when Mikhail Kwiatkowski, who was in that lead group, gets dropped, who I said last week looks a little washed up. He's only 30, but he's just not been himself since like 2017, 2018. And I wasn't surprised to see him dropped here. Michael Gogol, who is kind of a real journeyman rider on NTT, gets dropped here, but incredible that he made that selection. They'll later get picked up by Brent Bookwalter, who was dropped a little bit earlier, and Zindik Stibar, former winner of this race, incredibly good bike handler, very good rider. And then Kwiatkowski actually gets dropped from that chase group. Oh, and as Kwiatkowski was getting dropped, Max Schachman actually unclips on a steep climb and had to start from a stop, which is really tough. But he looked very strong today. Not surprising that he could catch back on. 47K to go. They're still chasing Fuglsang. Van Aert, Wout Van Aert and Greg Van Avermaet are kind of separated themselves slightly and they're chasing him. Jakob Fuglsang was descending. He was descending incredibly well on the gravel. It's really hard to descend on gravel. He was in really well. He's a former mountain bike, like former professional mountain biker. So it was interesting to see him. You know, he was really able to show those, his background and his skills on the gravel. And also, so if we just go through that lead group, you have Jakob Fuglsang, former pro mountain biker, Wout Van Aert, multiple time cyclocross world champion. You got to have great bike handling skills to do that. Greg Van Avermaet, he's a roadie, but he's a classic specialist. He's an incredibly good bike handler. And then I'd say Schachman, Bettyol, and Formolo don't totally fit the profile of being good on that surface, but clearly they're making it work. I mean, I was shocked with Formolo. I would not have picked him for a race like this, and he looked very strong in that lead group. With 33K to go, I have a note that Wout Van Aert is on the front way too much. He's always on the, he always does this. To me, maybe it's slightly, you know, it's partly ego. He knows he's strong, so, you know, why not work? But also his background is in cyclocross, where you are on the front all the time. There's not really the drafting benefit and tactical element that there is in road cycling. So I thought he was on the, he did this at the Tour of Flanders last year in 2019. He was on the front with like 80K to go, just wasting energy. And he didn't win that race. He probably could have if he would have ridden it smarter. So I thought this was just like part two of that. And I have a note that Greg Van Avermaet, would not leave that last wheel. This is like classic old guy on a fast group ride. You're just playing caboose at the end of the group. Someone comes off the front. You drop back a little bit, force them in front of you. He was doing that every time. I was, you know, this either goes two ways. Either he's being really smart and saving energy and kind of playing possum back there, or he was just hanging on for dear life, which we know he now that he was just hanging on for dear life. And it was wild to see a guy of that caliber just at the limit. You know, he's one of the strongest riders in the peloton normally, and he was just pegged. I mean, if you looked, they were showing power numbers on the TV screen, and he looked, it was, you know, they're doing like 450, 500 watts every time they were on the gravel going uphill. So I can't imagine that. That seemed incredibly hard. And so at 26K to go, I actually have a note where there's, you know, we have our six leaders out front. We have the three chasers behind, Stibar, Gogol, Brent Bookwalter. And the gap actually gets down to about a minute here. And I thought it could get interesting if they started playing cat and mouse up front, that group would come up behind him. But it ended up not happening. It did get down to 24K to go. It's down to 54 seconds. But with 20K to go, up in our lead group, Max Schachman attacks. He takes Wout Van Aert with him. They got a big gap. It was out to 17 seconds by 19K to go, so 1K later. And then right after that, we're on a steep gravel climb, and Jakob Fuglsang just easily bridges it. It was shocking how easy that seemed for him. He just popped right across it. So at this point, I'm doubting casting aspersions on him for his age, thinking, oh man, this guy's going to win. He's going to crush these guys when we get into Siena on the short, steep climb at the finish. So after Jakob Fuglsang's bridge, we lose Greg Van Avermaet. He's just popped out the back. So that was kind of confirmation of, you know, is he just being smart or is he hurting? He was just hanging on. Any type of acceleration was going to drop him and he's gone. 18K to go. Alberto Bettyol attacks. He looked really strong. But, you know, these are, looking back, that bridge by Fuglsang and Bettyol's attack were probably mistakes. I think that probably put him into the red with A, just the tough racing, and B, the heat, and they can never quite get out of that. So 17K to go, we're all back together, and Fuglsang and Formolo, I have a note here, are at the back, and I thought, you know, I have a note, are they cagey or really hurting? Formolo was actually being cagey, he was fine, but Fuglsang was hurting. In retrospect, he never quite recovered from this. So 15K to go. I have a note. We have four riders in their 20s and one in their 30s. So we're left with five riders, four in their 20s, one in their 30s. Not surprising if we have, you know, the historical data bears that out. So 12.3K to go. Woot van Aert, who's the heaviest rider in this group, attacks on a climb and drops everyone. I thought it was Fabian Cancellara-esque, the former Swiss time trial powerhouse who, you know, this was vintage him attacking from like 10 to 15K out on a climb, even though he's the heaviest guy and just dropping everyone. And that's exactly what happened here. And I will say, so Wout van Aert's listed at 75 kilos on Pro Cycling Stats, and he could very well be 75 kilos, but he looked fit, like thin. Like you could see his ribs through the back of his jersey when he was bent over the bike. So whatever weight he's at is probably about the skinniest he can be and still be this powerful. And he's been doing big training camps in the Alps. So he's certainly lean and ready to go, whatever weight he's at. And when you look at him on the bike, he kind of looks he could be like a professional soccer player. Like he looks like a traditional athlete riding a bike versus a lot of cyclists are kind of emaciated and don't look that athletic. So even though he's heavier, he's just, you know, his body's in symbiosis with his weight, and he was flying up this hill. So he immediately gets like a 7-second gap. Jakob Fuglsang is dropped soon after this. So all the old guys are gone. We have four riders in their 20s in the top four positions. Betty All, who responded to the initial attack by Van Aert, gets dropped. So we're seeing a theme here. Like it's just so hot and the race is so hard. Anytime you go into the red to do anything, you pay for it a few kilometers later. You just can't recover. And I think maybe these Euro guys are a little surprised by that. They're never really racing in like extreme heat. And this is like a classic thing in extreme heat. You just can't go too deep because you can't recover. There's a descent with 6.5K to go. Woot's gap was 13 seconds. He's a better descender than Shackman and Formolo. And he's getting pulled back on the descent. My wife's theory is that the motos in front of him were slowing him down. So I get on that BetMGM live betting odds at this point, and it's actually a really cool dashboard as the odds are changing in real time. So as they pulled him back, the live odds for Woot went out. So, you know, going off my wife's theory that it's just the motos and they're not actually pulling him back because of them being stronger, I put a little bit of money on him as, you know, to win live. And, you know, he ended up pulling that gap out. The odds got worse, but I was locked in at that better price. So it's kind of an interesting thing you can do. It's a really cool dashboard. I would recommend checking it out. So Woot's by himself here and Formolo and Shackman are chasing him, you'd think in theory they're better off because there's two of them, one of him, two stronger than one. That's not really how this works in practice because he can commit fully. Like if he stays away, he will win. He just has to cross the finish line first. For them, it's a little more complicated. If they work too hard, they're going to pull the other up to the leader and then get beat by the guy they just pulled up. So they're always holding something back. So a lot of times you see this happened to Sagan in, I think, believe it was a 2015 World Championships in Richmond, where he was away and it was Bossenhagen and Greg Van Avermaet behind him. It might have been Greg, and he can stay away because they're starting to play cat and mouse behind him. And that's exactly what happened here. You know, they get close, they get within like, you know, 8 seconds, and then he starts pulling that at 5K. It's back up to 11. By 2.6K, it's up to 18. So he's if he doesn't fall apart on the climb here, he's going to win. And actually, 3 years ago, Wout van Aert cramped on this climb into Siena, this steep climb to the city, fell over, and he still got back on his bike and got third. But I was a little worried about, I was thinking like, oh, if that happens again, that'd be bad. But stayed on his bike, won, really impressive. Other notes, it's a huge second place for David Formolo, who overtook Shackman on the final climb. He was clearly playing it a little conservative, just kind of racing for that second place, not putting too much into the chase, hoping he could beat Shackman on the climb, which he did. Also, great result for Shackman in third, and Betty All in fourth. This is his first big one-day result outside of his Tour of Flanders win last year, which some people, me included, maybe thought was a fluke, but this is great confirmation that that wasn't, he's a rising star in these types of races. Other notes is the older riders just looked old here. Like the established stars of the sport looked old. Possibly this is just, it was hot, first race of the season, short, you know, we'll see how things play out in these races to come, but something to keep an eye on. Also, I had, we talked about last week, Wout Van Aert's odds were plus 1,000, which I thought was, you know, pretty interesting bet. So I put a few dollars on him, got a nice payout on that. Did the live bet on him. That was terrible payout, but I kind of thought it was a sure thing. So pretty good. I lost some, I bet on Casper Askren, Peter Sagan, and Alexei Lutsenko also to win. Lost money on all of them. But when you're playing these long odds like that, you can just put a little bit on a couple guys. And if one of them wins, you get a great payout. It more than covers your losses. Looking back, maybe a Shackman and Bettyol would have been good bets for the podium. Formulo would have been a great bet, but I didn't see that coming. So, you know, hindsight's 20/20. A lot of these look obvious in retrospect, but these one day races are so hard to get right that it can be a little foolish to try to chase these betting on these winners. And when you're betting on cycling, it's important to note you don't necessarily have to know that you don't have to get the winner right. You can just, you know, you can bet on, if you get long enough odds, you can bet on like 5 or 6 guys who are likely to win. And if one of them wins, it covers you, it more than covers your losses, and you still get a nice surplus payout. And this is more of in grand tours where maybe there's only 5 or 6, you know, people physically possible of winning the race. And just the way the books are set up, they're not totally right. I feel like this is a little bit of a hole in the logic of on the betting systems. So you can just bet on the six favorites, you know, taking out a couple of the big names who don't actually have a chance to win, and you'll win no matter who wins. Other takeaways here is Wout Van Aert was on rim brakes, which is like really odd. Like you never see that. You would never see that in an amateur gravel race, and you're seeing it less and less in the pro ranks. But a lot of the favorites had troubles with flats, which is like everyone's going to have flats in this race. They should see this coming. But with the discs, it's tougher to change the wheel. They had slower wheel change, and a lot of them just rely on bike changes. But when you're in these races like this, your bikes can get stuck behind. You could be waiting a few minutes to get a new bike. And I think I bet Julian Alaphilippe, Sagan, Matthew Vanderpool were all on disc brakes. I wouldn't be surprised if that played a role in, you know, them not making the final. But yeah, I thought that was interesting. Wout was on rim brakes, really savvy move there. So Vuelta a Burgos, we're not going to talk too much about this. It's a small Spanish race. We don't want to read too much into it. But so Remco Evenepoel, who I talked about on stage one, looking incredibly strong, won on the stage three summit finish. And then on stage five, he didn't win, but he just kind of rode really, he showed a lot of savvy, just hanging in there, staying. The Ivan Sosa was the winner of the race. And then Mika Landa was second. Remco was third on the stage. And he showed a lot of poise to me just to like kind of hang in there, not go too deep, you know, knowing he had the overall win in the bag. So that's something to note. Also, so Ineos, Sosa got dropped. He's the winner of this race the last 2 years, and he got dropped early in the climb on stage three, and Ineos just left him. Richard Carapaz was in the lead group. They just stuck with him and went with him. Fine, right? But Carapaz gets dropped on stage five. Sosa wins. Now you've like split your results between two riders, and you get nothing in the overall because they've both lost time on different days. If they would have just circled the wagons around one of the riders, like let's say Sosa on stage three, when he gets dropped, the team stays with him and can limit his losses. And then maybe he can put enough time into the peloton on stage five to win the overall. Or Carapaz, when he's getting dropped on stage five, instead of winning, Sosa stays with him and helps him pace. Maybe he could have, you know, protected, let's say he had a lead. Maybe he could protect that lead. This is at Burgos. It doesn't really matter. But it shows the problem with this let the road decide strategy, and it kind of foreshadows possible issues at the Tour de France. If you're always going with the strongest rider of the day, you're just going to continue to have these problems where rider A takes time on stage four, rider A loses time on stage seven, rider B, who lost time on stage four, gets time on stage seven, and you're splitting your gains and losses between different riders. It can really be a problem. And I wouldn't be surprised to see this happen at the Tour. So just something to keep an eye on. Mika Landa looked great, but this is classic Landa. Don't read too much into it. He looks really good in small moments and then looks really small in big moments. Also a note, Joao, the young Portuguese rider on Dakuna Quickstep. He's 21 years old. Totally overshadowed by Remco, who's also on that team, who's 20. but he looked really good. He got fourth behind Remco on stage five, rode in a third overall, got on the podium overall. That's something to keep an eye on. Just note that. So Milano Sanremo is this weekend. So there's five monuments in cycling. There's Milano Sanremo, Milan Sanremo, Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, Giro de Lombardia, and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Sanremo is, traditionally, it's early in the year. It's like, it's in March. From Milan, obviously, to Sanremo, the Mediterranean coastal town. And it's interesting thing about it, it's 300 kilometers long. I believe it's like 299, since that's maybe, I think that's the limit of what World Tour races can be, but they have like a notoriously long neutral rollout, like 40 kilometers from Milan doesn't count. They just kind of roll along so they can get within the 300K limit. This is a very old race, like over 100 years old, but they've lost the course this year because the beach is such religion in Italy in the summer, in August especially, that the mayors of the towns along the coast didn't want the race disrupting the Saturday traffic to the beach, which is like crushing traffic. If you're ever out riding early in the morning, close to the Mediterranean, you'll see like it's like it would be like 7 a.m. New York City traffic, you know, just like backed up for 40 kilometers from the coast, people trying to get out there. So it's actually not surprising. I was surprised when I first heard this, but it actually makes sense that I'm sure this is like this is the most important economic time for these cities. So Milano Sanremo, it's the hardest race. They say it's the easiest race to ride, even though it's 300K long, but the hardest race to win. And it's a total lottery. It's almost impossible to predict. It's really hard to win and almost impossible to predict the winner because the race is so easy. Like, this thing's like 7.5 hours long. You can turn it on with 40 minutes left and not miss a thing. Like, they just kind of cruise from Milan. There's a mountain pass that takes you out of like that breadbasket area of central northern Italy. You go up and over down to the Mediterranean, and it's not even on TV. It's that far out from the finish, and nothing happens. In 2013, there was like a snowstorm, and they had to get in the team buses and like drive the mountain pass down to the other side. And everyone was like, yeah, this is like so insignificant. It doesn't really matter. Just we'll skip the mountain pass. You know, we'll all jump back on our bikes to the Mediterranean and we'll go along the coast. And like, that's just like, it's a very traditional race. It's very beautiful when they get along the coast and they're weaving along these cliffside roads, but it is boring. It's really boring. So it's kind of a blessing in disguise they got kicked off this course. They had to drop a new course. It goes through the Piemonte region of Italy. So you kind of get some of these like foothills of the Alps, like around Torino, and then come into the coast that way. Now you get less time on the coast, but we still get the two important climbs here, the Cipressa and the Poggio. So the Cipressa is, I think it's about like 20 kilometers from the finish. They're not long climbs. They're like 5-6K long. Or the Cipressa is 5.5 and the Poggio is 3.7K. So they're short. They're not particularly steep either. They're like 4%, 5%. So they're ridden really fast. And this is called the Sprinter's Classic because of this, because the sprinters can get over these things. And then they finish on the Via Roma, which is just like this beautiful palm-lined avenue in Sanremo. It's a great finish. So you could start watching at the base of the Cipressa and not miss a thing. It gets exciting after that, though. Even though it's a boring, long race, it kind of builds into this like beautiful crescendo where the tension builds over kilometer after kilometer. And then by the Poggio, they're flying up this thing and the descent is terrifying. It's these tight coastal switchbacks into town. And you'll see like 2 years ago, like Vincenzo Nibali, who should not win this race. So he attacked on the Poggio and then he's such a good descender that he just sliced out enough time on that he could hold off the sprinters in the finish. So it can be a really exciting finish. It's kind of like the perfect, like, Italian mentality, which is like, oh, yeah, throw it on, whatever. But even though we have like this slightly better course this year, it's still that these mountain passes they're not going to be hard enough. They're like 2.2 to 3% average climbs, and the last one is 70 kilometers from the finish. So I think it's too far. It's unlikely you could attack there and hold off a strong, motivated peloton coming into Sanremo. So I think it's going to be more of the same. And like a little peep behind the curtain, I'm going to be on vacation next Saturday. And I'll probably just catch like the last, I'll catch the last hour of this race, and I bet I don't miss a thing. And if so, if we get into like trying to predict this, it gets really hard. Just because what I said, it's so easy to ride. It's really a lottery once you get down to the Via Roma. And usually it's unlikely for the favorite to win this. So Wout van Aert, if you look at the betting boards, Wout van Aert's a plus 600. He's likely, and I want to make a note here. Cycling on the Cycling Tips podcast, they were saying Froome is the second best. He's the second favorite on the betting odds. So therefore, the odds makers know what they're doing, and they're predicting him to win. Well, that's actually not how this works. The odds makers don't care. They're not trying to predict the winner. They're just trying to get even money on all sides and limit their exposure to a single outcome. So if a bunch of people are betting on Froome, they'll make his odds less advantageous by, you know, making him a quote-unquote favorite to keep too many people from betting on him. So you'll get like the big names will have worse odds because more people will bet on him. The odds makers make money no matter what. They just need you to bet. They don't need to predict the winner. They just don't want to be left holding the bag if too many people bet on Froome and he wins, you know, and they have to pay out like an oversized amount on one single rider. So don't look at these and think, oh, these guys know what they're doing. So, you know, Caleb Ewan's a plus 700 at Sanremo. He's going to win. Like, no, they know that people know who Caleb Ewan is, and they have to make his odds worse to keep you from betting on them. So that's just an important way to look at this. So, but plus 600, if you think about like, so last weekend it was Matthew Vanderpoel at plus 300. So the odds, you know, the odds show you how hard this thing is to predict. Even the favorites a plus 600. But so Wout van Aert, he's coming off a win. It's kind of tempting to bet on him here, but the favorite they don't normally win this race because everyone marks them on A, the Poggio, and then B, when you get down to the Via Roma, everyone will just be all over him when they try to jump. So I wouldn't bet on him. You rarely see the odds on favorite win at this thing. And we have Caleb Ewan at plus 700. He's tempting here. He's good. I tend to underrate him. I probably have a personal bias against him. He's very fast. He's like a very good sprinter, very aerodynamic position. I don't think he's not like a big, strong rider who can like, you know, really get over these climbs and win on a finish like this. And he just never performed that well here. So I wouldn't be totally wrong. So we have Matthew Vanderpoel at plus 700. Those are pretty bad odds for a race like this where it's just so hard to, you know, predict the winner. But he could win on a course like this. He's very fast in a finish. He hasn't been riding well this year though, so that's something to note. And also he's not good at long races. So the World Championships last year, which were like a 280 kilometer race, just totally fell apart. Like in the last 30K, like he looked like he was just going to win the thing easily, and then just switch went off. He couldn't ride his bike because he's young. He doesn't race a ton on the road. He's never raced a grand tour, so he doesn't have a big endurance engine. I would say that's going to be a problem here. Peter Sagan at plus 800. I don't love that either. Julian Alaphilippe plus 1200. He's last year's winner. He could. This is just so tough. I mean, he could win. I wouldn't be surprised if he wins. He's a good pick. Sam Bennett at plus 14. So this is really interesting. No, I'm sure no one watched this because why would you be watching this race? But Vuelta Burgos, stage four. He's like a bunch finisher, and he just like jumped on this climb. It was a kind of a tough climby finish. He jumped early, stayed away. He looked really strong. He is something to note. He's on Deconinck Quickstep, also the team of Julian Alaphilippe. So that could be a problem. Last year, Elia Viviani was a sprinter. He's an Italian sprinter, so this would be like the perfect race for him to win. He was actually forced to work for Alaphilippe on the Poggio. So Bennett could be held back by his team, but I think he's a good pick here. Fernando Gaviria at plus 14. He's another rider who's in incredible form. Great finisher. I would actually pick him for the win here. Gilbert at plus 1800. He's not going to win. He's 38. If he wins this, he gets the monument sweep. So he's totally motivated. And that's like absolutely why he will not win. Like people can smell the desperation on you and will just mark him out of the race. Like everyone knows Gilbert wants to win this. It's like, therefore he will not win this. Cause he's just, everyone's going to be all over every move. I guarantee you he jumps on the Poggio and like, they're going to be right on him. And then after he jumps, they're going to mark him. The next guy to go could get a gap. It's not going to be Gilbert. Matteo Trentin at plus 2,000. He's a good rider. He could win this, but he's not a big favorite, but interesting. And then we have like Elia Viviani at plus 2,500, who I actually bet on. There's no indication he has any form. I wouldn't recommend betting on him. It's just total hunch. Like Italian rider, he hasn't been riding that well for like the last year. You know, this could be like a great slump breaker. I just have a feeling about it, but no data to back that up. Kwiatkowski at plus 2,500, former winner of this race. As we saw last week, though, he's just like, he's lost something. He's not the rider he used to be. Matej Motorik, something like that. The Slovenian, really strong rider, plus 2,500. He could win this thing. He's been like a top, I believe he's at a top five here in the past. He's really good. Michael Matthews at plus 2,500. He's another rider who could maybe win. But yeah, don't bet on him. DeMar at plus 2,500, former winner, but there's rumors that he had to hold onto a car to get over the climbs to win that. So I wouldn't look for him to repeat. Shackman's back on the board at plus 2,500. Absolutely not going to win this, but love that he's on there. This is a tough one. My bets are, I have money on Sam Bennett, Gaviria, and Viviani. And an interesting thing to note here. So in the last, this is called the Sprinters Classic. So between the year 1997 and 2016, except for 2 years, we had pure sprinters winning every edition. So that shows you like just how sprint specific this race is. But in 2017, 2018, 2019, we've had non-sprinters winning. Kwiatkowski, Nibali, Alaphilippe. And I actually wrote a piece for this on my blog last year. I'll share it in the newsletter this week. But so the speeds have been getting faster and faster on the Poggio like every year for the past 5 years, and it's burning off the sprinters. And these classic riders have been winning as a result. And even last year, we saw Viviani setting the pace for his teammate Alaphilippe, which is like, that's like sacrilege, where an Italian sprinter is forced to work for a non-sprinter teammate in an Italian sprinter's race. You know, I don't think that's like a sustainable trend. At some point, it's going to swing back to the sprinters. That's just my hunch. So, and Bennett is so strong. I mean, both Gaviria and Bennett look so strong that they could probably weather a pace, a high pace on the Poggio and still win when we get down to the Via Roma. But so, I mean, this is all, take all this with a grain of salt. This race is so hard to predict, but just have fun with it. So last note here is there was a small race this morning, a small French race. I believe there was actually no TV coverage because there was problems. It's called La Route de l'Occitane. And if you remember in episode one, we talked about Pavel Sivakov on Ineos just being in absolute great shape, flying at the team camp, just ripping the legs off everyone. His teammate, Egan Bernal, last year's Tour winner, has been stuck in Colombia, so we haven't got a good read on how good a form he's in. He actually beat Sivakov. He won the race, beat his teammate by 10 seconds on a summit finish, and there are some big names further down, like big names like Chris Froome. I'm looping this in later. I was looked at the results sheets this morning, and I didn't even notice Chris Froome because he was so far down. He's over 5 minutes down on Bernal and Sivakov. Also, we have Thibaut Pinot, Richie Porte, and Romain Bardet between like 30 seconds and a minute and 20 down. But wow, that Froome result is, we talked about it in the first episode. We were looking at the team training camp data that he was off the pace. But wow, this is a little shocking and confirmation that we should be watching Bernal for the Tour. So I just got a hold of some Twitter roadside videos since I couldn't find the race on broadcast, and it looks like Froome was working as a domestique for Bernal, which is strange. I mean, that's a Tour winner usually is tuning up this close to the race, so that's something to keep an eye on, but also explains his large time loss. He probably pulled up at some point, but it shows that Bernal for now is a leader at Ineos. I feel great about Bernal. If he can stay out of his team politics too much, he's looking more and more like the eventual winner of that race. Bradley Wiggins, the 2012 winner, he's an eccentric guy, 2012 Tour winner, eccentric guy, said on his podcast this morning that Bernal would have cracked in the last stage of the last year's Tour de France if it would have been held in full, if not for the weather causing mudslides, and they had to cancel the last mountain stage, essentially. I don't know what race he was watching, but Bernal was like by far the best rider and climber in that race. And he thinks Geraint Thomas, who's his friend, would have won. And he thinks Thomas should be given free rein in this race because Bernal was given free rein last year in the Tour. Bernal wasn't given free rein. He was just much stronger than Geraint Thomas. So when the race was live, was hot, Bernal was following wheels and putting time into Thomas, who couldn't hold the pace. So the only time Bernal really went alone was in stage 19, which was to pull out the competition, likely for Thomas, likely for, you know, an eventual Thomas counterattack, but he wouldn't have been strong enough to do it anyway. I mean, Bernal's the strongest guy on that team. They need to consolidate around him right now for the Tour. And Wiggins doesn't, I have a theory, he actually doesn't watch that much professional cycling, doesn't really know what's going on, but he does symbolize kind of this voice within the Ineos structure that they should be backing someone other than Egan Bernal, which is insane and they shouldn't do, but that could get messy at the Tour. I think that's the only thing that can get in his way. He's in great shape. He's a really savvy rider. He doesn't let too much bother him, but I would worry about this. So that's our episode this week. There'll be a newsletter coming out later this week with some visual aids for the Strada Bianchi recap and a little bit more in-depth preview on Milano Sanremo. I'll be sharing the blog post. You can find that on Beyond the Peloton blog from last year about Sanremo with some of the climbing speed breakdowns and et cetera. And I'll be having like a list of favorites and who I would quote unquote recommend betting on. I wouldn't recommend putting any significant amount of money on this race whatsoever though. So thanks for joining me. And if you enjoyed the show, make sure to rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. It helps others find the show. But thanks for joining me, and we'll be back early next week talking about Milan Sanremo. And I think it's gonna be a great race. It's gonna be really fun. Feels good to be back enjoying racing again. So thank you so much and have a great week.